Majority Report. Where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. Even Saturday and Sunday are casual. Sorry, Jesus. So don't forget your denim hip huggers. Don't forget your bootcut jeans. We're not afraid of dungarees on the Majority Report.
All right. We are broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. at the Hyatt Regency Hotel, where I am attending the Families USA Conference. And sitting with me, I am very pleased. Hold on for one second. There we go. Sitting with me is Tom Hartman.
Hey, Sam.
You may know him from the Tom Hartman program. You may know him from RTTV.
Big Picture.
The Big Picture, the new television program. And so, Tom, thank you for joining us. And forgive me if I'm still fiddling here, because this is our first time doing a remote broadcast.
Oh, it's a hoot.
Yes. We're patching it together a little bit. Let's get into this a little bit, because we've been talking a lot of healthcare here.
Yeah.
And one of the conversations I had was with Wendell Potter, who you interviewed many times.
Yeah.
And he is the former insurance executive who is now essentially exposing, in many respects, the insurance industry. And we were talking about, and I'm going to be playing an interview with him a little bit later today, we were talking about a concern that the size of the healthcare reform bill, and so much of it is left up to the actual execution by states, in terms of exchanges, in terms of regulations. You know, we're starting to see these regulations start to roll out, that they'll be chipped off one by one.
Sure.
And we'll be left with just sort of the insurance corporation's dream bill, as it was.
Yeah.
Is this a concern that you have too?
Yes, absolutely, Sam, on the one hand. On the other hand, the cool thing that happened with this is that, although it's going to take some enabling legislation that may not get through given the House, but you know, Ron Wyden is pushing for this for Oregon and others, it can be done by 2014, but it would be nice to have it done now, is that this bill opens up the possibility of states just going off on their own. Now, Rick Perry down in Texas is saying, we're just going to go off on our own. Screw you guys and screw all of the Texans. But in Connecticut, they're saying, we're going to go off on our own and offer a public option and have a statewide health exchange with a public option in it. So basically, they're going to take their Medicaid program and offer it to everybody if they can do it. Vermont is talking about doing just a plain, straight, absolute, everybody participates, no one's out, everybody's in, all 670,000 Vermonters, single-payer system. And, in fact, their governor, Peter Shumlin, ran on that platform, was elected on that platform, and that's how he opened his inaugural address. And the legislature's behind him on this. He's a former state senator and a good guy. And so I think that there's, like, you know, sort of like Social Security when it was first rolled out in 35 wasn't the end-all and be-all and certainly didn't cover even a fifth of the people that it covers now. It was a foot in the door, and which is why people were so hysterical about it then. And I think one of the reasons why they're so hysterical about Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act or whatever you want to call it now is that it has opened some doors. It has set some markers down. You know, the thing that the insurance companies actually have to pay 20% in benefits, that's a BFD, actually. I mean, you've got some insurance companies out there that were skimming 50% off the top. You know,
right. I mean, I guess, you know, part of my concern is that, for example, that provision that you're referring to, where the medical loss ratio
right.
essentially means that 80% of their revenue must go into medical care. The other 20% for profits and for advertising, shareholder dividends. But the what defines what is medical care?
Right. The insurance companies are lobbying to say that the person who answers the phone and says, you know, yes, we'll process the payment for your prescription, that's called medical care. In fact, they would like to lobby so that their CEO, you know, taking his, you know, Stephen J. Hemsley with his $477 million for his first 5 years, that's medical care.
Right.
I don't think he's ever given a vaccination to a child, but, you know, or anything else. But yeah, you're right. The devil's in the details.
Yeah, and that's you know the that's really sort of the concern at that point is that we're talking about regulations that can actually be manipulated in such a way so that
yes.
those definitions. But
which is on the one hand, thank God we have a Democratic administration. On the other hand, lots of mischief can be done if a Republican's elected in 2012.
Right.
Which is why the Koch brothers are having their meeting at Rancho Mirage, you know, this weekend.
That, 2012 becomes so important because once this thing rolls out, once people have a taste of this, they're going to want more.
Just like Social Security, there's going to be no turning back. You're going to have people, you know, it's like those people who show up at the tea parties with "Keep your government hands off my Medicare." You know,
right.
I mean, it becomes iconic.
Yeah. Speaking of which, and you know, I want to talk about sort of. And maybe this is actually rolls into it, because I think, you know, when we were talking about what we were going to talk about before we started broadcasting, you know, you wanted to talk a little bit about corporate power in this country, and it affects everything. I mean, it is, to the extent that progressives were unhappy with the how far the ACA went, it was because it allowed industry, the insurance industry, complete unfettered access to everyone as opposed to having a national public option. When we look at things like this talk of deficit reduction on the back of Social Security, which contributes nothing to the deficit, it's a function of there not wanting to be taxes on the high end, income taxes, corporate taxes. How do we fight this, particularly in the wake of Citizens United?
Well, that's the big problem is the Supreme Court. I don't know how wonky you want to get into this, but there's some great stuff in the weeds here that I find fascinating. I wrote a book about this called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. When the Constitution was written, there is nothing in the Constitution that says that the Supreme Court can declare a law illegal or unconstitutional, that the Supreme Court can strike down a law. It's simply that it's the final court of the land. So if you and I had a lawsuit, it goes through court after court after court, and finally it has to end, and it's supposed to end at the Supreme Court. That was the idea of the founders. And in fact, in two of the Federalist Papers, there's specific reference to that. So in 1803, in 1800, when Thomas Jefferson became president, in what was called the Revolution of 1800, because John Adams was just this tyrant right-winger, you know, with the Alien and Sedition Acts, he threw 20 newspaper editors in prison. Jefferson was his vice president. He left town the day that happened in 1798. When Adams lost to Jefferson and Jefferson became president, Adams finally, his final screw you to Jefferson was to put on his last day in office, to make the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court Jefferson's second cousin, John Marshall, who was one of the most hard right, vitriolic Federalists in the United States, who was Thomas Jefferson's number one hated political enemy. In 1803, in a case called Marbury versus Madison, John Marshall ruled from the bench that the Supreme Court could strike down laws passed by the legislative branch and signed by the executive branch. Jefferson freaked out. He wrote a letter to Spencer Roan, who was the Chief Justice of the Virginia Supreme Court and the son-in-law of Patrick Henry and a close friend of his. And he said, if this decision is Marbury versus Madison's case, he said, if this decision is allowed to stand, then the Constitution has become a fello de se, which is Latin for a suicide pact. He said, this decision gives into one of the three branches, and the unelected one at that, and I'm pretty much quoting verbatim here, and the unelected one at that, the power to strike down laws made by those elected by the people of the United States. It is the most anti-democratic thing that can happen. In this decision, the Constitution becomes a thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, the single unelected branch of government. And he basically predicted what we're seeing right now. He was totally freaked out. He was unable to muster any effort to roll it back. Marshall hadn't done anything that was impeachable at that point. And ever since 1803, the Supreme Court has been the most powerful branch of government. Most Americans have no idea this.
Right.
They don't realize this. And in 1886, in the citizens in Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, this was the first time the Supreme Court seriously took a case. There'd been a few smaller ones, U.S. versus Dartmouth in 1815, but 1886 is the big one, where the Supreme Court actually took on the argument of whether corporations should have rights as persons, in this case under the 14th Amendment that was passed to free the slaves. And there's a direct arc from that to Citizens United. The important thing for people to realize is that this is 100% the Supreme Court. No legislature has ever passed a law saying corporations should have rights. In fact, the opposite.
Right.
In Citizens United, they struck down the Tillman Act of 1907. No president has ever signed a law or even given a speech saying that, that citizens should have, or that corporations should have rights as citizens. In his State of the Union address in 1887, President Grover Cleveland, referencing citizens, referencing the first case, Santa Clara County, said, "The average citizen now, the neck of the average citizen is now trampled by the iron heel of corporations." I mean, it's incredible.
So what do we do? I mean, so what do you do at that point?
Well,
I mean,
basically, this is the same problem that Franklin Roosevelt faced in 1836. He was trying to pass New Deal legislation, and the Supreme Court kept knocking it down. The Lochner Court that came into power in, I think, 1912, they struck down child labor laws as unconstitutional. They struck down the 40-hour work week or 50-hour work week as unconstitutional. They struck down the minimum wage as unconstitutional, all these things. And so Roosevelt said, okay, the Constitution doesn't say there have to be 9 people on the Supreme Court.
Right.
I'm going to raise it to 13. And, of course, he almost lost his presidency over that. I mean, it was, you know, everybody, even people on his own side, lost, you know, he left him on it. But changing, but what happened was, as a result of that, and all the brouhaha in 1937, even though the court hadn't changed, they started agreeing with him because they realized that they'd gone too far. And there has to be, I think, and this is where the guys at the Center for Human American Progress and you know, a bunch of other groups are doing really great work on this, showing that Scalia, Alito, Thomas, I mean, Thomas, 3 days before George Bush made him Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, ruled in the Homden case in a
Roberts.
Charge,
Roberts.
Roberts. Yeah, I'm sorry, I said Thomas. Yeah, Roberts. 3 days before that, I mean, you know this. This is the most corrupt justice in history. We've got at least four.
He was interviewing for a job with the Bush administration while the Homden case, which was basically about presidential authority, and maybe one of the most important cases about presidential authority.
And might have even put Gonzalez in jail.
Yep. Was being adjudicated by the court that he sat on,
and he was the deciding vote.
Yep.
It was a 3-2 vote, and he was the deciding vote, or 3-1 vote, or 2-1 vote. Excuse me, three judges. So you've got that. You've got Thomas Line for decades. You've got all these other. It's time for us to be calling out the Supreme Court. Number one. Number two, people have to realize the stakes of the 2012 election.
Yeah.
Because Scalia is 74 years old. Kennedy is 78 years old, I think, maybe even 80 years old. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the oldest.
Right.
But she'll probably retire before Obama ends his term. But you've got several conservative justices, and whoever's president in 2012 is going to appoint the most powerful body because of that idiotic 1803 decision that made Thomas Jefferson crazy, the Marbury case. And so I'm almost to the point where I don't care what Obama does. I mean, he could be the most mediocre president in history, just so long as I have a Democrat in 2012 to appoint the next Supreme Court justices, so we can flip the court to the left, so they can reverse Citizens United. Because really, it's
that was actually what I was thinking in 2000 in terms of Gore at that point. I mean, that
was
at the end of the day, it was the Supreme Court, not to mention all the other federal judgeships.
I think that's why they stole it.
Yeah,
this has been. I mean, the Federalist Society. You know, go back to the Powell memo. Take control of the judiciary. That's
right.
The key. It is an entire branch of government that is unelected, unanswerable to anybody, lifetime appointments in most cases. I mean,
John Roberts was down there as part of that, the Brooks Brothers mob, too. Wasn't he part of the mob.
What he did was he used to be Rehnquist's clerk. So he knew Rehnquist personally, and he knew how to argue before Rehnquist. And so he went down and he coached Ted Olson and the other guy who made the arguments in Bush v. Gore about how to appeal to Rehnquist. And he's never admitted this in public, but he was, quote, officially on vacation in Tallahassee at that time.
Tallahassee is a wonderful place to go on vacation,
yeah,
particularly during those times.
I
mean, Scott Milliken, who's here with me because we're here for Ring of Fire. He's the producer. He's from Pensacola. Tallahassee, great place to go on vacation.
you're getting an awful grim look.
Well, you know, Tom, I want to let you go because I know that you've got to do your own show, and it was very generous of you to come by. And this is
this is the issue of our time, because ultimately one of two things is going to happen. You know, the Great Depression hit the United States and Germany at the same time. We had FDR, they had Hitler.
Right.
We're gonna. This Republican Great Depression is not over, because the structural stuff hasn't changed. We still have insane trade policies. We don't make things here anymore. I mean, we've got some real problems. And I'm very concerned that 2012, 2014, 2016, sometime in the next 6 years, probably at the most, we're going to flip in one of two directions. And there is going to be a flip. And we're either going to flip in a Pinochet direction. I don't want to use European analogies because everybody says they're over the top, so what the hell. We're either going to flip in an authoritarian right-wing direction,
right,
or we're going to flip in an FDR Sweden European direction. And that's the reason why the right is so hysterical about the word exceptionalism. Because if you say that America is exceptional, it's code for saying we're not going to go the European way.
Right.
We're different than that.
Right.
So, you know, we're gonna be making a choice in this country, and the court is gonna have a big piece to it. And you're doing great work, Sam.
Oh,
keeping the word out there. Please keep doing it.
Thank you, Tom. I will. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Great.
And of course, Tom Hartman's show every day, 12 to 3 on just about every progressive station across the country.
Free Speech TV. And
sometimes it plays 3 to 6, too, I think, in New York.
Say that.
New
yeah.
York,
yeah,
3 to 6.
Yeah, WWRL in New York. And we're also on as television on Manhattan Neighborhood Networks.
Great.
In all five boroughs.
All right, thank you very much, Tom Hartman. And so, later in this program, it is Casual Friday, folks, and it's a little bit less casual than normal. I'm actually wearing a sport coat, and because I am in Washington, D.C. for the Families USA conference, and now we're going to try to bring Chris Rosen on for our and unfortunately I do not have Chris Rosen's I hope he's not going to be pissed. I don't have Chris Rosen's theme song. But he'll have to deal with it. Let's call him, see if he's home. Chris Rosen, of course, comes on every week to give us his picks on the week's Netflix or on-demand streaming. Chris Rosen, are you there? I'm great, Chris. Hold on for 1 second. Let me see. I can hear you. Hold on for 1 second. Let's see if... and hopefully the sound quality is still good. I've got... Well, yes, I'm curious as to what is going out. Hopefully I'm not echoing. And so, Chris, I'm doing very well. I'm in Washington, D.C. Oh, yeah, that would have been uncomfortable because no one would have answered. And then you would have thought that it was because we didn't want to let you in. Which would never, ever happen. Oh, hold on for 1 second. We're having a little trouble with you, I think. Let's see. Oh, there we go. Okay, that should do it. All right, Chris, you want to speak?
Hey, Sam, how are you?
Yes. I'm doing good.
Oh.
I think we're better off.
Okay.
And okay, you were saying that you were going to stop by the office today as a surprise to me, and you didn't realize I was in Washington, D.C., and I suggested that might be a little bit uncomfortable.
Right,
and
you know.
I didn't answer
so
before.
I'm glad I didn't do that. So what are you in D.C. for?
I'm in D.C. for the Families USA Conference.
I've been
down here with Ring of Fire Radio, which you know I'm doing every weekend now with Bobby Kennedy and Mike Papantonio. And I should also say, this week I'm talking to Marcos Melitzis, and Pap has got a great interview with Mike Taibbi
So you may want to check that out if you don't appreciate Chris Rosen's Netflix.
That's right. I might actually do that, too, if I don't appreciate them. So.
Right. Now, I should tell you that I ran out of Caprica episodes. I got confused. I thought I had one more. I liked the ending. I wish it was going another season. The show got...
Yeah, I never saw it. I got to be honest.
I thought.
I'm still waiting to watch Battlestar with, you know... I still haven't done that. No.
You haven't watched Battlestar Galactica?
I know. I'm sure you are, but...
Email,
you know, what can I tell you? You don't... There's only so many hours in the day, Sam. You can't watch everything.
Well... Yeah, but you're watching crappy stuff, and you're not
true,
stuff
probably true. Well. Anyway, so we could do a couple of things this week. You know, we could do on demand and instant watch if you'd still like to go through with this. What the hell, right? We're here.
Yeah, I guess we might as well.
So the Oscar nominations were this week. Did you see those?
All right.
No.
No, but I did hear that Gasland was nominated, and we just...
That's right, Gasland was nominated.
Fox last week, so...
And also nominated was Exit Through the Gift Shop, which I think we had discussed once before. That's the one with Banksy.
Yeah,
he's a, you know, graffiti artist who no one knows who he is, and he directed his movie, and it's like kind of meta, and you're not sure if it's real or not, which as we've discussed is... So that was also nominated, and also nominated was Restrepo, which is a documentary about the Afghanistan War. And Sebastian Junger,
right,
journalist, and Tim Hetherington, photojournalist, they went to... Afghanistan for a year. They were embedded with the 2nd Platoon, and this is available on Netflix Instant Watch. And I would say you should watch it because, you know, it's one of these, it's a pretty, you know, it's a very surreal, like, you know, visceral documentary, and I think, you know, it's pretty good.
Do you feel like it's weird that you didn't ever recommend any of these films before? Well, I mean, it's just like all the...
Oh, that's not true.
That ...nominated, you didn't recommend.
That's... You don't listen to the segment half the time. What? No. But Restrepo is a good movie. I didn't actually even know it was on Netflix Instant Watch. I think it's actually a recent add to Netflix Instant Watch. At least that's what I'm going to tell myself. And you can watch it, and then you could be... It could be fun for you because then you'll be able to catch up on all the Oscar-nominated movies. So you've already seen Gasland, and then you've got this one, and, you know, Exit Through the Gift Shop, and all of a sudden you're halfway there to being all the Oscar-nominated documentaries you'll be able to see. So that's fun.
Fantastic.
On Demand, another Oscar movie, which I think we may have discussed a little, but I'm not sure. Winter's Bone?
I don't think so.
No, I'm not. I try to, you know, don't worry. But Winter's Bone came out over the summer. It's an indie movie. Why you should care about this movie is that, you know, is me. Yeah.
Is it
senior editor?
You're a movie line, right? You're the senior editor? Is that?
Yeah.
That's a paid...
Sam, I've given you great stuff. The Town.
Okay.
I'm just saying.
I'm just trying to...
Kids Are All Right, I gave you. Joan Rivers. These are all great movies. Not Kids Are All Right, that sucked. But, you know, otherwise, you know, these are good. Anyway.
I don't understand how you actually suggest a movie to me.
It's about 8 weeks later, for starters. And two, I think you should see these movies. That way you're in the cultural conversation. Whether or not they're any good is, you know, if they're good, that's nice. But Kids Are All Right, you should have seen.
Wait a second. We have a major miscommunication. About what
I'm just saying.
Here.
No, you don't have to watch bad movies. It's
bad
just
movies, so that I know what people want.
But people are gonna. This is why, because people are gonna say, "Oh, Kids Are All Right." I don't know why we're even talking about this right now. But people are gonna say, "Kids Are All Right" is a great movie, and then you could be like, "Nah, that sucked," because I watched it. Unless you didn't watch it.
Yeah, no, that's not healthy for me because what happens is I don't.
Well,
watch
you know,
anymore.
They don't all suck.
They suck.
Winter's Bone, good movie.
All right, well, give me a good one for on.
The problem is, I don't know how entertaining you're. It's not an entertaining movie. It's dark. You know, it's like a dark movie. Not that that's bad, but if you're kind of want to like escape for 2 hours, you're not going to want to watch this. But if you want to see a good movie, you can watch this. And it came out over the summer, indie movie.
Okay.
nominated for Best Picture. Jennifer Lawrence is the star. She plays, you know, a young girl in the Ozarks who goes looking for her meth head father, who may or may not be dead because he put their house up for collateral for bail, and they could end up losing their house. So it's like kind of like, it's like this, you know, not really. No, not really. A lot of meth heads, a lot of Ozarks. I mean, it's, you know, it's what you'd expect from that. And Jennifer Lawrence is great in it. She got nominated for an Oscar. John Hawkes, who's in it, who you might know if you ever watched Deadwood, or, you know, he's been in a million things. I think you would recognize him if you saw him. He was also nominated for Best Supporting Actor. So it really did well this year, the Oscars, and it was kind of a surprise in a way because it's such a low-budget movie. It, like, premiered at Sundance last year. And that people remembered it this far, you know, a year later is nice. And you know, it's a good movie. And so I think you should probably check it out. That one's on demand, and it's, you know, regular price, like $4.99. Winter's Bone.
What's it called again? Winter's Bone.
Yes.
And Rest Repo.
I think those are good movies. I mean, I think you'll like them.
Well, fair enough. Yeah.
I don't remember. You know, I don't remember what we did last week.
I feel like you're doing.
Maybe I'm trying. I tried to do more preparation for you.
Of course.
You big site, very popular site.
One of those sites where
your listeners are welcome to come check it out. I mean, they might enjoy it.
All right, it should be interesting. I mean,
yeah, we have good stuff
over there and see.
No, come on, we have good stuff. A lot of great interviews. So it was fun. So who's down there in D.C. with you?
All right. Well, I'm down here with Scott Milliken, and I've interviewed Wendell Potter. He is that former insurance executive. In fact, that's going to come up shortly after I'm done talking with you. And I just spoke to Tom Hartman.
Get out. Mark Riley still knocking around?
From Air America.
Tom, I think, over your shoulder.
Uh-huh. He's doing the morning show on...
Yeah, he is.
You do. He is over my shoulder.
Nice. Sounds good.
And
I look forward to checking out the whole podcast.
And meanwhile,
sounds good.
All right. Well, great.
You gonna be back in New York next week?
All right, Chris.
Bye.
Yeah, we'll see you next week.
Chris Rosen from I can't remember what the name of that thing. Movie Line? I think it was Movie Line. Chris Rosen from MovieLine.com, and in just a moment, I'm going to play for you an interview that I recorded for Ring of Fire with Wendell Potter in just a moment. A very interesting interview, and talks about both, I guess it's predicated on the notion that as it stands now, the Affordable Care Act, the health reform, is a pretty good bill and balance. Tom Hartman expressed why it's advantageous for us to have to really put a foot in the door this type of reform. But there are some concerns, not just with what the legislation did not achieve, but some concerns about how it gets implemented. And that's very much what the conversation I had with Wendell Potter. Today's going to be a short show. I'm probably going to end it with this Wendell Potter interview so that I can post it today, but we'll be back live in the studio on Monday. And I would encourage all of you first off, obviously, to become a Majority Reporter, Majority Report member. It's this piece of equipment here that I'm using, this blackjack that's allowing me to broadcast from here, and sound pretty good, is a function of a couple of people joining as dirty effing hippies. And if they didn't do that, we wouldn't have hit my goal for the month, and wouldn't be able to buy that piece of equipment. But the more people join, the more equipment you're going to see. We're going to get that the phone call technology quicker, and it's just going to be a better show. There's just no two ways about it, because we're going to be able to hire more staff. So please, if you have the opportunity to become a Majority Report member, please do. Of course, as always, justcoffee.coop for your coffee, chocolate tea needs, put in the coupon code Majority, and you get 10% off. And Just Coffee keeps sponsoring this show, so it's a win-win. It's called a twofer in radio. It's like four for Friday. You can get coffee, chocolate, tea, fair trade, discount, helps me, four for Friday. There you go. And I would also encourage you that if you're listening live after the Wendell Potter interview, go to the Majority Report Twitter feed. We've got a link up there to Al Jazeera live footage coming in from Egypt. What's happening there is unbelievable. We just spoke to Professor Juan Cole earlier this week about Tunisia, and he felt it was highly unlikely that this was going to spread, and within days, this revolution seems to have spread to Egypt. And we are going to try and talk to Juan Cole again on Monday or Tuesday to get an update. This weekend's going to be very tumultuous there, and I think we're going to know at the end of this weekend, is this going to mean the end of the Mubarak regime or not? Next week we'll also talk about this report that's come out as to the causes of the financial crisis. And you'll recall, hey, this is several weeks ago, we were talking about this, and the Republicans had decided to release their own report because they didn't want to go along with the majority report, and they had stricken from their report the words Wall Street, derivatives. They specifically did not want to use those words. So their report must be almost sort of like reading it like a children's book. Like, you know, the little financial crisis that could or something. But we will talk about that. And, of course, many other news stories that I've got backed up on my computer from the past couple of days. So now I'm going to play this interview I did yesterday with Wendell Potter. And then I will talk to you on Monday. Okay, joining me now is Wendell Potter. He was a former corporate public relations executive and head of communications for the insurance company Cigna, and several years ago left and wrote Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. He is now a senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity. Welcome to the program, Wendell.
Thank you, Sam.
So, when you look at the Affordable Care Act, where do you see any potential? Obviously, there are Republican attempts to repeal it and repeal aspects of it. But where do you see the pressure points that insurance companies will try to take advantage of, any type of loopholes or things that they specifically might want repealed?
Yeah, in fact, the whole notion of repeal is nothing more than a smokescreen, because it's not going to get repealed. Insurance companies do not want it repealed, and I think that's an important point that people need to understand. They need this legislation, so the Republicans are just going through the motions of this. It's somewhat nothing more than really political theater. What is really going on, the insurance company's lobbyists are meeting with the newly elected members of Congress and their old friends in Congress to tell them, to give them a list of things that they want done. They'd like to have the consumer protection stripped out. They'd like to have the new restrictions weakened or stripped out.
Now, by consumer protections, you're talking about things like rescission?
Yes.
You're talking what else?
Well, the prohibition that they can't use pre-existing conditions to stop selling insurance. They say they're willing to give that up as long as we all are forced to buy their products. But they also don't like the provision that they have to spend at least 80% of what we pay in premiums on our medical care. So they'll try to weaken that. It's not just at Congress, though. In fact, some of the most important work is going on in the regulatory area. Within the Department of Health and Human Services, they've got a lot of clout. Now that they've got more numbers in Congress, they feel emboldened, and so they can put more pressure. Plus, they use their allies in the business community to pressure the administration as well to make some changes or to make the regulations as lenient as possible for them. And they'll be working on the state level as well. This legislation has to be implemented at the state level.
With things like exchanges.
That's right. So a lot of the focus for them is shifting to the state capitals, and they are there in large numbers at every state capital to try to make sure that their needs are addressed first and foremost.
Does it concern you that when you have a bill that is this large and this complex and with so many parts that are a function of its execution, in other words, regulations, how the states implement it, that there is a tremendous amount of opportunity for the insurance companies to essentially peel off those aspects?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the danger. And one of the reasons it's so dangerous is it's not being watched very carefully. The media doesn't really know or care that much about how this is going to be implemented or how the regulation is going to be written and then put into place or enforced. There are great opportunities for the insurance industry and the other special interests affected by this legislation to get what they want and get it done behind the scenes, slip things through, and we are completely unaware of it, and the media is just as unaware of it as the rest of the country.
One of the things I've heard in discussing someone who deals a lot with insurance companies, a friend of mine, on a professional level, not because they've... he said that one of the things that he's heard insurance executives talk about is the idea that one of the ways they're looking to get around the 80% cap... And first of all, maybe we should describe what that is. Describe that for us.
Right. Since 1993, or maybe before that, insurance companies have been reducing the amount of money of their premiums that they spend on their medical care every year, and it's primarily because of pressure from Wall Street on the for-profit companies, to the point that it's called a medical loss ratio. They consider it a loss when they pay a claim or spend any money on their medical care. So the pressure from Wall Street is for these companies to spend less and less and less, to the point now that they only spend about 80 cents of every premium dollar we send them on medical care. Wall Street wants them to keep ratcheting that down to spend less and less. Congress, in this bill,
and that is because they will have higher profits, obviously.
That's right.
And more dividends for their shareholders.
That's right.
And,
okay. If you're spending less on medical care, there's more left over to pay executives high salaries and to reward shareholders. And so that's the whole game. That's what it's all about. And of course, there's great resistance from Wall Street and from the executives. They don't like that. They want to try to weaken that. And they're already asking for exemptions. And a lot has been going on. And the administration, the White House, has pretty much been blackmailed by big business into granting some of these special exemptions from this, because they're told essentially, like for McDonald's, that if you don't give us an exemption, we're going to stop offering benefits entirely. The reality is a lot of these companies are offering inadequate coverage in the first place, but the administration is so afraid that these companies will stop offering benefits at all that they're acquiescing to it.
Now, so why would McDonald's want an exemption on that medical loss ratio, or are they looking for exemptions on other things?
No, you see, the medical loss ratio also pertains to big insurers. McDonald's self-insures. And most of us are in self, and we don't really realize this, but if we work for a big employer, that employer is self-insured, so it essentially is an insurance company itself. It uses one of the big insurance companies to administer the benefits, so both of them are in the game together, but we're really talking about the employer's money here. So they have a big thing in the game here as well.
And what of what of the notion that insurance companies could also begin to offer their products in a more a la carte fashion as a way of skirting that that provision? In other words, what we consider health care becomes a narrower, more narrowly defined, and then all these other add-ons like dental or eye care or maybe even going further than that. Is there room for them to engage in that type of practice?
Oh, there absolutely is. In fact, a very important thing that's going on right now, the Department of Health and Human Services has to write the details of what will be contained in what's called an essential benefits package. The new law requires that insurance companies and employers offer at least a minimum level of benefits. Mm-hmm. Well, the insurance companies want to make sure that's as narrow as possible,
right,
so that they can sell other stuff on the side. And they money on it. They want it to be as narrow as possible because that gives them a great deal of flexibility to sell all kinds of products, to segment the market, and when they do that, all those products are immensely more profitable.
Do you think that this is going to work? I mean, do you think that the Affordable Care Act, by the time the rubber meets the road, which is still 3 years off for most of the provisions, do you think it's actually going to work?
I think it's a foot in the door. I think, as I've said, this legislation is the end of the beginning of reform.
Mm-hmm.
It'll do some good. If it's implemented as designed, as Congress intended, it will bring a lot more people into coverage. It will keep some of these things from happening that have been going on for a long time that should have been outlawed many, many years ago. So, in some regards, it will make our system or hopefully make these insurers behave better and be more consumer oriented, but they have so many opportunities to get around it, as we just talked. The other thing is we might have better legislation or better approaches at reform at the state level going forward if they can do it. Vermont is going to be looking at something quite different and quite more far-reaching. So
more or less a single-payer health care system.
It is. They'll be considering that. And the insurance industry will be hitting that state just like candidates hit New Hampshire.
Right.
When they really start taking this legislation up, they'll be there in large numbers devoting enormous amounts of resources. They don't want a single state to fall, and so they'll try to keep Vermont from becoming single payer.
Is there something in the Affordable Care Act that is incentivizing states to do things like this?
States are encouraged to experiment. Now, there are some restrictions on that because they were almost required to implement some of the aspects that they are required to implement some of the aspects of this reform, such as setting up the exchanges. But there will be flexibility for the states, and some states are doing more than others. Connecticut, for example, may have the first public option with something it's doing right now. If they can figure out the funding, it may pass. So Connecticut may actually have the kind of public option that was originally envisioned for the federal legislation.
I mean, would you say that because there is so much opportunity for the insurance companies, for ideological foes of any type of health care reform, to peel off certain provisions, would you say that the best aspect, very general term, of the Affordable Care Act is simply that it is enshrining in the public's mind a notion that health care is a right in some way? I mean, do you think that aspect of it is important?
It's an important thing. But I've found, as I've spoken so much on this issue and traveled so much, that people are really divided. A lot of people do not believe that health care is a right. Many people believe this is America, and I made it in this country. That's the American way of doing things. I started out without very little, and I've grown a business. So why is it a right? I mean, it's to me, it's a privilege. Some people just are wired to think differently.
Right.
I do think, though, that more and more people, as they become victims of a broken healthcare system, are going to figure out that we need to do something more than what we've had.
And what's going to take? Part of the problem with healthcare in general is simply that 20% of the population uses 80% of the care.
Right.
And so people may not realize how bad their health insurance was before because they didn't need it yet.
Yeah.
And generally you find out how bad it is when you need it.
Right.
how do we overcome that? I mean, that's one of the biggest concerns that I have, is that we're going to be peeling away at this stuff, and at the end of the day, we're just going to have we're just going to have a mandate, and yeah. All the other provisions are going to be weakened to the extent that they're not terribly meaningful.
It's a danger, and you're exactly right, and that's been why it's taken so long for us to get any kind of reform passed, because people do think, well, what's wrong with the system? I'm insured. I'm healthy. But the thing is, the health insurers' business models are not sustainable for the long haul. Their current business model is to try to shift more and more of the cost to us. And even those of us who are not chronically ill, we're going to find that we're paying a lot more out of our own pockets just to go to the doctor or to pick up our medications. And we're going to find out that more and more of us can't even do that because our insurance companies are refusing to pay for things that we need that they've always paid for in the past. They're not doing it now because to do so is not profitable for them. So the more and more people realize the game that's being played by the insurance companies and how this is making them incredibly more profitable, maybe they'll finally wake up.
Well, I hope so. Wendell Potter from the Center for Public Integrity, thank you so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you, Sam. Glad to be here.
And that, folks, concludes... Oh, not really. That, folks, concludes today's show. I hope it wasn't too messy, but we're working on making this all more seamless. So have a good weekend, and check Majority FM on Twitter for a link to Al Jazeera to track what's happening in Egypt. It's very stunning, and we will be talking about that next week. Until then, have a great weekend, folks.